So, sorry to force you back inside for another lecture on this lovely day. You know, according to the schedule, I have half an hour.
No, don't worry about that.
Okay.
Nobody really
well, I'll try to be
you have an hour.
Quick. Okay.
You have an hour.
So, the idea behind this talk is that I've been doing a lot of different pieces of work in the last couple of years. And I'm supposed to be finishing my PhD next year, so I thought it might be a good opportunity to try to put them all together into one coherent presentation. So this is, you know, the first attempt to really try to integrate all the different things that you're interested in. And, you know, just see if it works, how does it not work, and if you have any constructive feedback on how to present them the better, that would be very much appreciated. Okay, so basically the main theme is just going to be an active cognitive science, and I'm going to be looking at ways of trying to push that approach further forward in terms of its philosophy, science, and experiential practice. So the overview of the talk is just a very brief introduction, some personal motivations of why I got interested in this in the first place. then I'm going to briefly go over the theoretical framework of interactive cognitive science. I mean, I can't spend too much time on that, but I'll try to give you a flavor of what it's about. Then some work I've been doing in the artificial life modeling, and I'll spend some more time in that section because that's really my original background. I was trained as a computer scientist / cyberneticist in the University of Reading, and that's what got me initially into Sussex, so a lot of work I've been doing there in that category. And then I'll conclude with some brief experiential considerations. So, part one, introduction. So, a brief personal history. Initially, I started off being a naive materialist, you could say. You know, both my parents are secular, very scientific. So, in some sense, you know, anything that could be explained by science, you know, that goes, and everything that's not scientific, you know, that you start questioning. But then I started exploring some altered states of consciousness while I was an undergrad, and that kind of just sort of blew that framework out of the water completely. So, you know, just a blank slate, you know, what now? But I found that the more I explored those altered states, you know, they actually started raising more questions than giving me answers. So instead of continuing down that path, I actually started reading a lot. And some of the things that I was interested in, I've listed here. So in philosophy, I started to be interested in Husserlian phenomenology. In epistemology, I looked at radical constructivism. In science, I was particularly interested in second-order cybernetics. And I also started looking at spirituality, in particular the Eastern contemplative traditions. So it was my great luck that... the problem was, how do I integrate all of these different things, right? It's very, you know, varied reading. But then it just turned out that the kind of theoretical framework that I was being taught at my lab in Sussex, namely in active cognitive science, kind of integrates all of these. So that was a really unfortunate coincidence, and I call it a postmodern synthesis, perhaps. Okay, so just to lead up to what inactive cognitive science is all about, here's a diagram that I created to explain kind of the evolution of the field of cognitive sciences since its inception. So we have the cognitivism proper starting around the 1970s, and we'll have basically the mind and cognition, everything is computational. Then in the 1980s we have the connectionist moving, so looking more at dynamic and emergent properties of cognition. Then in the 1990s people realized, well, hang on, okay, that's all very nice, but even though things are emergent and dynamic, you know, what's missing here is being embodied and being embedded in the context, so the situatedness and so forth. And that's kind of what we call the embodied embedded approach to cognitive science. And then, you know, today and going forward, I think the next move is towards an inactive approach. And the way I would see the distinction between that and the embodied embedded approach is that life, you know, living in the sense of biological identity and lived experience in the sense of subjectivity start to play a crucial role and actually start providing the foundation. But I put the diagram as an outward arrow. So to indicate that all of these expansions still includes what happened before. So it's not that, you know, they're excluding the other paradigms. It's just that we're looking at a broader picture, basically. So it's kind of an expansion of the domain of what cognitive science is about. And actually, interestingly, you know, just watching the video of Amanda before, you can start, you know, just as an idea maybe, you know, at what of these expansions, you know, does she start to be considered as a person? Would be one of the questions we could think about, for example. Right, so that's a little bit of the history of the shift towards inductive cognitive science. So inductive cognitive science, like I said, consists of a variety of things that I was interested in, such as Husserlian phenomenology, but it also talks a lot about dynamical neuroscience, systems biology, simulation models, constructors of epistemology, and so forth. And some people at my lab have recently written a nice paper on an active approach, New Horizons for the Mind, I think it's called, where they draw out a couple of crucial concepts that they think define an active approach. And these are embodiment, emergence, autonomy, sense-making, and experience. And I found these quite helpful in explicating the phenomena of life and mind. Okay, just to clarify something, the notion of an action, even though it came from the book The Embodied Mind and a couple of other papers that Varela published around that time, has been adopted by Oregon and Noe and a few others to really signify an approach that used to be called, you know, sensory-motor contingencies. And as I see how these two approaches fit together is that, well, the inductive approach, as advocated by Varela and people, encompasses the Oregon, Noe, and so on, but actually Noe and Oregon are missing out some parts that for me are really crucial in the inductive approach, which is basically the living body as an autonomous subject, and also the pre-reflective lived experience of the body. And Evan Thompson has written a really nice paper saying exactly this as well.
Which one do you have in mind?
Sensory motor subjectivity, and the title goes on. But if you look for that, you'll find it. You can probably find it on his website as well. So one thing that I should also point out is that I'm finding trouble saying inductive cognitive science to this what I'm interested in, because I find that really what we have is something completely new. Yes, we have the cognitive science, and in some sense that's what's giving us the empirical data, you know, but we're also using philosophy of mind, and also we have an experiential component, which is called mindfulness in this diagram. So the problem I have is, how do I relate all these three aspects into one coherent PhD thesis? You know, I'm going to try to say, you know, try to see whether that's possible in this talk to some sense.
We're trying to get a Department of Reality Study set up in San Francisco.
Well, you know.
No, I'm not studying.
Yeah. Well, I think we should. Okay. So that was just the three main branches. We have the experiential, we have the theoretical, and we have the empirical. Now, of course, these require different methods to investigate. And so we have a kind of like interrelationship between them. They each mutually constrain each other or inform each other, you know, or prompt new experiments or new theories and so on. And I've said a little bit about the theory and experiments in my talk on, what was it, Sunday night? With the inactive torch. So I kind of covered that part of my work already, so I'm not going to go into that anymore. But I will say something about the minimal modeling, the artificial life aspect, and something about the experiential practice in this talk. Okay, so let's start with the theoretical framework of inactive cognitive science. This is a diagram that you can find in one of our supervisors' papers, but it's by DiPaolo, Rode, and De Jager, which is a very nice overview of what inactive cognitive science is about. So it starts at the very basis of life, which is something that we go all the way back to the 1970s in Maturana and Varela, and they talked about autopoiesis, but it goes all the way to human projects as well. And there's an interesting trend here that was also noticed by Hans Jonas, which is that there's an increasing immediacy when you go down that scale. So, for example, in the shift towards animality, what you had is that suddenly the organism was able to move around, but it also meant that the food was not directly attached to the body anymore. Like, you know, the roots are grounded, there's always our sunlight coming. But with the move to animality, there's an immediacy between your desires and its resolution or its satisfaction. But that increasing immediacy always goes with greater freedom as well. So it's a kind of strange dialectic that you can find in all kinds of stages in the biological phenomena. I'm not going to say much about all of these, and particularly the later ones. Inactive cognitive science hasn't really gotten around to exploring in greater detail. But it's really the most radical place is the beginning, which is the autonomy of the living. Okay, so the embodied mind was followed up by Evan Thompson's book, Mind and Life. And that was an important step for me because it really complemented the embodied mind by focusing on the role of living being in the theoretical framework of an active cognitive science. So I put a little diagram there on the left, which is to show that the way that this approach is trying to bridge the explanatory gap between mind and matter is by referring to the concept of living being. Because on the one hand, we have the living body of the organism, which is a material organization. But on the other side, we also have the experience of the lived body. And both of them make reference to life. And so perhaps, you know, with this kind of shift of having the living organism as the center of the framework, we'll make some sort of progress towards bridging the gap. Maybe the question will be dissolved or will disappear if we reshift our focus in that way. But of course it raises the question, what is exactly the relationship between the two halves, the living body and the lived body? So the way that the inactive cognitive science tries to address that question is to start with the notion that living beings are autonomous. Now, that's basically the most fundamental tenet of the inactive cognitive science. What that means is that we also say that they continue to produce their own identity, and Hans Jonas would say their being is their own doing. And the paradigmatic example of this is the living cell, where the metabolic processes constitute themselves and the boundary which makes it possible for those networks to exist. But of course the boundary also can't exist without the metabolic network in the middle producing it. So you have a kind of codependent relationship between these different aspects of the self. But this kind of self-constitution of a unity, of an identity, can be found in many domains in biology. It's not just the metabolic self-construction, but you can also find it in the patterns in the nervous system and the immune system, perhaps social systems, and perhaps others. So it's a systemic property. It's not necessarily limited to metabolic self-construction. So, of course, the most famous example or formalization of this is autopoiesis, which takes this notion in a very particular domain, namely the biochemical domain, in which we can find the single cell. Now, instead of boring you with the exact definition, I put this Escher's painting drawing hands, because I think it very nicely illustrates that the idea is that we have active and creative processes which codepend on each other for their existence, and through that codependence create a unified structure. So you can see the hands are drawing each other, and through that are forming one unitary structure. So that's the idea of autopoiesis in the chemical domain.
So autopoiesis is really what Hofstadter should have been talking about in Gödel, Escher, Bach.
Okay, so that gives us the notion of an identity, a self-constituted identity. And the next move is to say that because that identity is self-constituted, we can start talking about a perspective that it generates onto the world. And that is actually a perspective on a world of significance, because the identity is not just pre-given, it actually depends on its continued operation in order to exist. So that kind of course, it doesn't solve necessarily the hard problem, why should there be like anything, but it does feel more intuitive to start talking about a perspective of concern at that point, namely a concern for survival. So Hans Jonas, for example, talks about survival being the mother of all values. But then my supervisor, Ezekiel Tupalos, followed along with this but said, well, if we only have an undifferentiated identity, that can only encounter an undifferentiated world. So everything is good until you die, because there's no way to distinguish between different things. So we'll just build on top of that and say, well, as soon as we have some sort of self-monitoring, self-regulating processes that can kind of measure, say, the homeostatic balance inside the organism, then actually we can have a differentiation of meaning. And that is what we're calling sense-making. So it's kind of a... the focus is on the making again. It's a kind of a creation of meaning through the continued operation of the system. And, of course, since the world also includes other organisms, that then leads on to participatory sense-making, which Steve talked about before. Okay, so I think that just covers the two most important notions that I will be using here, which is the autonomous self-constitution of identity and the sense-making that goes with it. So for the next part, I'm going to shift a little bit away from the theory and talk a little bit about the kind of work I've been doing in artificial life modeling and how it relates to this theory. So what really first got me into the University of Sussex was my interest in communication. And so that's something that I recently kind of refreshed and built a model of. So I'm just going to try to give you an idea of what kind of work that is. Okay, just to remind you again, so the perspective that we're adopting is one which emphasizes situatedness, embodiment, and emergence in the sense that behavior is a dynamic property of a brain-body-world systemic whole. So in the diagram on the right-hand side by Beer, you can see you can carve up this whole system in different aspects, but they're all structurally coupled with each other. And behavior is something that emerges out of interaction between all of these components. Now, coming back to communication, when you look for definition of communications in the biological literature, what you find is that, similar to how cognition was heavily influenced by the development of computers, so how we understand cognition was largely determined by how we understand computation, similarly, communication was largely understood in terms of information transfer. So this is the original diagram by Shannon Weaver with you have a transmitter, a channel, destination, and you sort of kind of pass signals across that across the channel. And it didn't take long for biology to incorporate that kind of theory into how it understood communication between organisms. So Hillman, an ethologist, says communication is the transfer of information by a signal sent in a channel between the sender and receiver. And this is, in biology, right? So they just kind of took the definition that you could find in the engineering disciplines and applied it to the biological disciplines. Now, coming from a different perspective, Maturana and Varela prefer to view communication as a form of behavioral coordination. So that gives us a quite a different picture of how we're understanding communication. And I want to draw it out as a choice between two metaphors. So on the one hand, we have something like that. We have a directed signal sent across, a channel. And on the other hand, I would say that we have something more like that, a dance. So information transfer versus dance, I think, is the choice here. And depending on which one we go for, that has quite a lot of different implications for how we understand communication and what we view as communication and what we don't view as communication. So if you go with the information transfer approach, then you will probably use the mathematical tools of information theory. You will view communication as something sequential, something disembodied, something that is transmitted, right? Something that is actually passed along, and it is likely to be viewed as being governed by fixed symbolic codes. Well, on the other hand, if you look at it as a kind of behavioral coordination, as in the case of the dance, then you're more likely to use dynamical systems theory, perhaps. You're more likely to view it as a co-regulated phenomenon that is embodied and constrained by contextual, biological, environmental considerations, and you have a whole range of things going on there. So just to so we have these two metaphors, and then just to put them to work and see what kind of difference does it actually make whether we adopt one or the other. I had a look at a particular psychological experiment that was done by Marin Turathan, and this is the kind of diagram of the situation, and I'll just talk you briefly through what this experiment is about. So you have a baby in one room, and its mother in the other room, and they're hooked up to each other through a double camera system. So they have a TV, and there's a camera looking at them, and both the mother and the baby can sort of interact and communicate across that system. And the goal of the mother is just to animate the baby and you keep it happy and laughing and just have a kind of playful interaction with them. Now, while that is going on and the baby is interacting with the mother, what they do is remove the live feed from the mother and replace it with a playback of what the mother was doing maybe in a previous trial or just a couple of minutes beforehand. And then, what happens? Well, basically, very soon the babies start becoming distressed, start crying, or just get, disinterested and look somewhere else. So this was puzzling for many of the people, because first of all, the information that's coming across the channel is the same, right? Before, what the mother was doing there was keeping the baby happy. Now we're playing it back, it's not working. So the kind of explanations that people came up for this usually had to do with talking about the baby's sensitivity to social contingencies, so whether there's a life interaction going on or not. And the way they explained this was mainly to postulate the presence of an innate module which enables the detection of social contingency, or some sort of innate capacity to understand intentionality and to process agency. So it's kind of like an internalized cognitive module somewhere in the baby that allows them to do this. So the question that we were asking coming from the dynamic systems approach is, do we really necessarily have to involve such complex, perceptual processes on the side of the baby to explain what's going on in this situation? Okay, so that was the big question. Now, the methodology we used to start getting some ideas was what I would call a methodology of minimal assumptions, which is basically evolutionary robotics. How many here have heard of evolutionary robotics? Okay, maybe it's just a few words. So in evolutionary robotics, what we're trying to do is optimize artificial systems by being inspired by just natural evolution. So we're going to have a population of solutions encoded in some way, and then just using some sort of operators, such as genetic variation and so forth, will create new variations, and these variations are tested in situations according to the criteria that you specify, and then the ones that do better are continued on with new variations and so forth until you're happy with the solution. The advantage of that, by the way, is that you're stepping out of the process of being the designer a little bit, so you're letting the system find its own best solution, so you're not pre-specifying what the best solution is. There is some influence, but there's less so. Also, what it means to test the solutions is that we can use some sort of synthetic ethology, so we can embed it in the whole context and study the interactions between the system and its environment in its full details, something that we can't really do with actual biological systems because they're too complex. And then, of course, we use dynamic systems to implement and analyze this process. So we have the situation that we had in the psychological experiment, and so we want to model it. So the way that we decided to do this was to say that basically what we have are two dynamical systems. That's a really just broad, general way of characterizing the mother and the baby, and saying that they're non-linearly structurally coupled with each other, so there's a possibility of interaction. And of course I'm not saying we can reduce them to that, but I'm just saying we'll try to extract them and model some aspects of that and see whether they can give us some new ideas about how to explain the situation, so it's not some sort of reductive step for what this is about. And of course, if it turns out that it was completely useless, the experiment, then we can start putting in additional factors of complexity to see whether that would help. But basically, the model that we then built was to have two simulated agents, which are just basically simple neural artificial neural networks, so dynamical systems that can move on a horizontal line, just back and forth, and they only have one sensor, which is a tactile sensor in the middle, so when they cross each other, they get a little, like, on signal. And their goal was to basically move as fast as they can in either left or right direction, as far away as possible from their starting position. Now, because they're actually facing each other, what they have to do is negotiate somehow which direction they're going to move in together. So both move like this, you know, they fail their task. If they move like this, they fail their task. So they have to kind of break the symmetry of their movement because they're looking like this, and then move off into one direction. So that's just, you know, a simple task of coordination. So we have something similar to what the mother and the baby are going on about, just some sort of coordination task. So that, what we want to test is whether under conditions where we robustly evolve this behavior to happen under very noisy and varied conditions, you know, if it happens that we replace one with a playback, you know, will it also make the coordination fail or not? And what can be learned from that? So I'm not going to go into this, but we try to make this behavior as robust as possible using a variety of measures. And here's the first outcome. We had on the left hand, we have over different generations. We have the fitness of the solutions going up, and then on the right hand side, we just initially tested the final fit solution. You know, how well is it doing when we displace it at different angles? So a variety of different positions. And it's doing quite well, and most of them, so it's quite robust to different initial displacements. But we just took the best initial displacement to make the solution even more robust. Then we started playing around with the noise in the system. We increased the motor noise by, 20 times, and they were still able to coordinate. And on the right-hand side, the sensor level, which is based, you know, the sensor is just the on-off switch, are we touching or not, we can increase the noise to almost 50% and they can still manage to do the task, which is amazing because, of course, the 50% is absolutely no information anymore in the binary signal. So they seem to be very robust solutions. So we were really pushing for them to be able to solve the problem even during the playback situation. And just to give you just a simple representation of what one of these systems would look like. So if you want to understand the system, what we can do is start looking at the dynamical system here, do some mathematical analysis, that's very difficult. And is there a question?
Is it okay to ask a question? Just to clarify, if I heard you correctly, did you say that there was a point where there was 50% or plus noise in the system, therefore there was no information being communicated between the two units?
Well, exactly at 50%. I mean, if it goes beyond that, it would be the inverse. It would actually start having...
Okay, yes. So at 50%, no information.
Yeah.
And nevertheless, there was still a structural coupling of...
No. Well, no, that would be basically no structural coupling, right? It's
so
completely formed by noise.
At that moment?
This graph here is the mean fitness of the solutions. There's 150 of them, and this is the sensor noise level. So at 50%, it's basically zero. They're not gaining any scores. So they're basically meaning that they're not moving coordinatively from the initial position at all.
We would expect that.
But I mean, what I'm just pointing out is that during evolving the solutions, I have 5% noise. That's something like here. That's what they were optimized for, the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I can almost push it to here, and they're still able to do it. So it's a very robust solution that evolved.
It was still able to do what?
The coordinating task of moving as far away as possible from the initial location together.
Even close to 50%?
Yeah.
You can see on the graph.
Yeah, it's this graph here.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically, this, you could think of this number here as how far did they get together away from the starting point.
Mm-hmm.
So as more and more and more noises, it's harder and harder for them to move into the same direction,
right,
further away.
Gotcha.
And that's not an easy task, because first of all, they need to localize each other, right? They only have, we are touching or not. So, you know, that if they're not touching, then they have no indication of where they are.
Right.
So, and then once they kind of found each other, then they need to negotiate, are we going to go left together or are we going to go right together?
Mm-hmm.
And then while they're moving, they have to stay kind of like around each other so that they don't lose track of each other. And so there's actually quite a lot of different things that they need to do in order to complete the task.
Thank you.
This is what it looks like. But okay, we don't need to go into the details of the mathematics of it. We can just have a kind of operational test of the system and see, you know, if we give it different tasks and have a look at the way they behave to learn something about the system. So in this graph, this is the best trial of all of the ones that we found. What we have here is the relative displacement between the agents, so how far they are apart from each other. This is the input that each of them is receiving, which is the same for both of them, because they only get one when they actually touch each other. The velocity, and this is just the different artificial neurons output. But what's so how do they negotiate? Let's focus on a particular part. So, well, actually, at the beginning you can see two of the parts, and then what they do is kind of like bounce off each other like this while moving together. And how that works is, can you see this? Sorry, I can't. Maybe if I stand here. So what happens is that if they're not touching each other, so the input is zero, this starts decreasing the output to the right-hand motor side. So the system actually slows down. And what this does is then it makes contact with the other agent, so the sensor goes up again. And this then powers up the motor again, so it speeds away again. So this happens in a kind of, you know, almost regular kind of way while they're moving together in the same direction. Okay, so that seems to suggest that they should be able to do this even if one of them is a playback, because the one should just bounce off to the side and they should be able to move off into the same direction. But it turns out that out of 150 trials of playback, so there's one way interaction where the behavior of one is the playback of that best trial, it turns out that the coordination is a drastic failure. They can't do it at all. So, whereas before we had the graph somewhere in this region of coordination, now the best agent... Oh yeah, can you see that?
Yes.
So before we had...
do it from over there.
Yeah, okay, sure.
I had my own...
All right. Okay, so before, when both were allowed to actively interact, we had something about here with the distance they managed to travel together. And now, with the best, you know, trial that we had, just showed you now, the best score, played back to the agent with the same conditions, same initial conditions, so on, he's not able to coordinate with the playback. We basically have almost zero. And the little bit of scores there is because they just randomly sort of, you know, move a little bit from the starting position.
But
so
I don't understand this. How can the playback coordinate?
It can't. That's his point.
Yes. Well,
I mean, if you let's say I would like to dance, and then I have this film of a dancer.
Yeah.
We can't dance. I mean.
No, but imagine you had a whole system, like imagine you're dancing with someone, and that movement of the other person is completely recorded.
Yes.
And then you start again with the same music, the same and then the person does exactly the same movement as before.
So I can coordinate with this projection, but this of course cannot coordinate with me.
Right, but could you?
Was that a surprise to you?
I don't understand.
On what theory would you have expected that coordination would have occurred just by playing back one of the coordination partners?
Well, if there was enough plasticity in the system, you might expect that it just bounces off this other thing, which just goes along a trajectory, and that would solve the problem.
So actually, you were testing if one of those two agents can do all the work.
Right, basically, So,
in other words, you test and see if it was just purely information exchange. Just
right, exactly. So it's kind of like, you know, well, what the other thing is doing is exactly the same as before when everything works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can the other one, the active one, still handle that, or do we need both for the success? Well, it turns out we need both. I mean, of course, I wasn't surprised, but I needed this result in order to say something useful about the situation with the baby. Because now we can ask, you know, how come the agent moves away, you know, because it basically drifts away from the one that's being played back, You know, is it because it has some sort of innate module to detect social contingencies, which is what has been postulated in the case of the interaction with the baby and the playback of the mother. So let's see what happens when we have the playback situation. So it starts as before, they have a little swerve around, and they do make contact here, but then what happens is the active agent just kind of runs into the other one slowly and surely, and after a while, basically, it actually starts saturating the left motor, which makes it slow down even more, so there's a point of no return in the sense that it just drifts out on the other side and just then never comes back. So, and this basically indicates that, you know, it wasn't just the one bouncing off the other, it was the other one also responsively moving away and coming back and forth. So it was really needed both for this. So, sorry. Yes, so this was this thing I was talking about. And so we wondered, okay, so what is going on that you know, makes the system respond in this way to the playback? And it turns out it's because that depending on whether the system is an input 0 or 1, the dynamical system has a different attractor. An attractor is usually something that the system falls into, and it determines a certain setting of the system, how it's going to act. But what we have here is actually that both of them, what happens is they switch each other into different attractors while they're interacting. So when it's down here, you can see this is a motor right, motor left, and this would be no speed. When there's no input, it actually decreases the output of the motors in a certain way. When they are in contact, it's above the 0 point, it increases the motor. So they're kind of actually regulating the speed of each other by interacting. So that was very interesting, because it means that in this case the behavior is not actually caused by any attractor, but by constantly kind of transiently shifting between them. Okay, not going to say too much more about this, but I think it's kind of out of the scope of this conference to talk about more about the dynamical system. But for us, so that was a very interesting result. But in any case, for the discussion coming back to the original psychological experiment, we have a new kind of way of looking at what was going on there, which is that the response of the baby doesn't necessarily need to be reduced to any internal mechanism of the baby, but it could actually be an emergent property of the situation as a whole. Right? It's the way that there were two dynamical systems, they're interactively coupled, and you know, one was changed very drastically by being non-responsive, and out of that change in the general structure of the situation, the baby basically became disinterested or something like that. And of course, you know, it doesn't say that this is what happens in the baby, but at least gives us a different way of thinking about what kind of questions to ask and what kind of studies to do in order to understand what the baby's response is about. Okay, and let's see. Right, just to mention something else that was very interesting to me at this point is that the agents were oscillating while moving along, but it turns out that if there is no interaction between them, they can't oscillate. What happens is they settle into one attractor, and that either means they always move left, they always move right. Right? So it's actually the case that without the appropriate interaction, the agents are incapable of producing oscillator behavior. And not just that, the behavior and the interaction dynamics are therefore very closely interrelated. So the behavior of the individual agents brings forth the interaction process on the one hand, of course, but also that interaction process, when it's established, brings forth the behavior of the individual agents, which is the oscillatory movement. So they're very closely knit. We can't just say that it's the behavior of one agent doing this, because actually it needs the other one and to produce that behavior. So coming back to my distinction between embodied, embedded cognitive science and inactive, so these were the kind of things I was interested in or was also originally, but I had trouble saying, why is this inactive? And of course it says something about participatory sense-making, which is part of the inactive framework. But in this model, we have a problem, because the actual agents or dynamical system I'm using are not autonomous. And that is supposed to be, you know, the fundamental thing about anarchic cognitive science, that we're dealing with autonomous systems. So in some sense, the model that I just showed you is actually more of an embodied, embedded approach to social cognition, not necessarily an inactive approach. And there's a lot of arguments why we can't use computational models to study constitutive autonomy. I'm not going to go into them now, but I just want to say that what turns out, I just, again, a lucky coincidence, that the way I described the individual behavior and the interaction process relating to each other, namely we have the individual behavior of the agents, that enables and constrains a global coordination pattern, and that pattern is actually what enables and constrains the individual behavior. Well, that's exactly the kind of autonomous loop that we're looking for in our study of inaction. So from that, I started to...
Before we move on, can I ask another question? In what sense does the coordination pattern... I can see how it constrains individual behavior. Mm-hmm. In what way does it enable individual behavior?
Without the coordination pattern, the individuals can't oscillate.
That's the couple. But for any particular individual in the couple, how does the feedback enable their agency?
Agency?
Individuals can oscillate.
I'm saying agents in America, they're not autonomous, they're just dynamical systems, but they can't oscillate if you don't have them coupled in a certain coordinative pattern.
It can oscillate, but it could move.
It could move, yeah.
Yes.
I'm just saying that particular behavior of oscillation.
The oscillation,
yes,
right.
Yeah.
You can't fulfill their task.
Well, and you can't fulfill
the other agent. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the problems that we have with evolutionary robotics is that we presuppose the individuals to be selected, in this case the two agents, in order to do anything with that method. But if you already have to specify what the agent is before we can start optimizing them, then we've already kind of like, you know, presupposed the solution to the hard problem, which is, why is there an agent at all? You know, where does the identity come from? It's not self-constituting if you already provide it to the algorithm. But when I looked at this relationship between the coordination processes and the global coordination pattern and the way that they reciprocally related to each other, I had the idea of reconceptualizing the method of evolutionary robotics such that we don't talk about the agents anymore as agents. Now we talk about them as certain dynamical components. And what we select is not properties of behavior of agents, but actually... a global situation in what I would call a dynamical substrate. And now, whether we actually have an agent in that simulation or not needs to be determined on a case-by-case basis. So what we're doing is kind of using the method of evolutionary robotics to optimize certain dynamical substrates which might have the potential of, when you run them, that there are processes in there which start to self-constitute an identity. And I think that's exactly what happened in the case of when we had the two agents coordinating with each other. So I wrote a paper with my supervisor on that, analyzing, you know, can we now call this coordination process that we have there a self-constitution of an identity? And we said, well, probably yes, but it's a very impoverished version because it doesn't really constitute a domain of interactions. Well, we have the identity, but, you know, it's not really going all the way to the sense-making. So that's some further work. Okay, so that tied all that back to the inactive notions of autonomy and sense-making, and I want to conclude with some considerations, experiential considerations. So just to refresh your minds from my previous presentation, I was talking about inactive perception and the work I've been doing that. I'm just going to draw out some things that I think are important. So it's a skillful bodily activity, it's intrinsically active, and basically, taking that approach allows us to explain how action can be perceptually guided in a perceiver-dependent world. So that was kind of like a summary of my previous talk. But here's the problem, because if we accept that living beings are autonomous and that they enact their world, then, as Varela and Thompson and Rush nicely put it in their book, the challenge posed to cognitive science is to question one of the more entrenched assumptions of our scientific heritage, that the world is independent of the knower. And, of course, this has a lot of difficulty in gaining acceptance in most scientific circles. And I think the problem is that it really must be grounded in personal experience to get any kind of foothold. And I like this painting by Escher to really illustrate that. That somehow the observer must become part of the observed experientially before all these theories even make any sense to someone. And this, of course, gives a methodological problem for how can we change the scientific community from one based on theory to one grounded in praxis. So I think I can think of at least three methods. I put them here: psychoactive substances, Buddhist meditation, phenomenological reduction, and you know, I've tried to practice all of these. But you know, ideally, and they have all of their advantages and disadvantages, and we can talk about them maybe after the talk. But ideally, what we want is a method is that, you know, effortlessly replicated and cheap, non-intrusive, simple to learn, blah blah blah, still generates interesting results. And so we you know, we get back to the inactive torch. So here I'm going to actually present it, you know, I'm presenting it as an educational tool, right? Something that you can pass on and change someone's experience to say, what is it like to bring forth the world? Well, here, try this, you know, go out and explore, and then, you know, we'll, they'll get a first taste of what that's like.
I think we'd all rather have LSD.
Okay, so last slide. Let me finish with some challenges and opportunities. So I know that, you know, we require a lot if we want to bring this forward. So we want the development of first-person methods, and of course I'm glad to be here exploring that dimension. But it also requires that we give up the ideal of absolutist objectivity that is in many ways the foundation of modern civilization. I mean, both the major ideologies that we have today, capitalism and communism, both kind of depend on materialist metaphysics to some extent. So it's not easy to give way because, you know, it's very much part of our cultural setting. And of course it would mean that we have to limit the authority of science to its proper domain of knowledge. And now since science has enjoyed so much authority in its history in the West, you know, they're not just going to say, well, of course, yeah, we're just kind of talking about this aspect and the rest as something else. So it also, you know, people don't like to give up their authority, and I think that's another major stumbling block of why we can't really push ahead with this. But on the other hand,
the point there would be to radically expand the domain of science so that actually it doesn't confine itself to just materialism.
So redefining the notion of science. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I want to end on a positive note, and which is that if we really push for this kind of new approach, then I think we can also gain a lot. On the one hand, I think we can reclaim what it means to be human. And that's something that we might want to discuss as well. And on the other hand, I want to say that an active cognitive science, at least to me, it seems to provide a scientific foundation for a radical responsibility for our world and others. Because as much as we say that we bring forth the world through our actions, you know, we are also responsible for that world. And it's not that we're just, you know, representing something that's already there. No, we are bringing it forth. Now, you know, we have to take responsibility for that. So, you know, maybe that's also why it's not popular. You know, it's not popular to have responsibility, so you know, that might be another problem. But I think it's also an opportunity to, you know, for a new foundation of ethics, and that, I think that's also very important. Okay.
So we have 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah. That was a lot of fun, and you know, I enjoyed the kind of spread of it. But I want to pick out just maybe a few basic themes, because you know, obviously you have large ambitions for the project. It moved from, if you like, a broad theoretical sweep to quite precise to the experiment,
right,
in a way,
right.
And then kind of went back again all the way to sales pitch for the adaptive control. So, as you know, because I hear talk in your department, that I'm pretty sympathetic to aspects of the inactive approach, but I really do have serious problems with aspects of it as well. And really, those serious problems have to do both with matters of detail and with the big kinds of issues that you got to at the end, and I'm kind of concerned a bit that
unless you can really, you know, kind of make those big jump steps, that you've got to watch yourself, you know, particularly if you're doing PhD thesis and whatever.
And you get Max as a
don't have me as an example. No way. But okay, let me be specific. So there are a few statements that I just wrote down where I thought, and so on.
Okay.
So at one point you had a line that you really liked where you said, well, their being is their doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written down the same thing with a question mark afterwards. And one of the reasons that I've got a question mark after that is because it's really important, in my view, to distinguish being from doing. And so there's this grand tradition which I see an activism that's feeding into or expanding, which is functionalism, computational functionalism in cognitive science. And basically what the inactive approach does is translate everything about mind and experience from causal relationships within the brain, which you can view from a third person perspective, to now saying, all right, it's not just in the brain, but we've now got causal relationships which involve the brain, the body, and the external world. And we can describe that from a third-person perspective. And, of course, when you start doing little bits of robotics, that's exactly what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so in a way, I'm almost giving the gist of my deep worry about this.
Sure,
it's over-extension. I'll just come back to it.
Okay.
So for all sorts of reasons, I think you can argue that what you call the hard problem, or lots of ways of talking about the hard problem, which is, if you like, what it's like to be something from the first person perspective, simply can't be translated into either, you know, just activities, you know, or causal relationships within the brain, or indeed the connected activities of brain, body, and world in dynamic. So we've still got this great dichotomy, and it looks to me as if, you know, you really were trying to make that reduction. And it seems to me also that you can be doing really useful work, for example, in cognitive science or in active cognitive science, without trying to catch that in your net, unless you can absolutely secure, you know, the you know, the trapping of the butterfly in the net. You should leave that butterfly to flutter by itself.
Okay, well, let me just point out that... I was actually thinking a little bit about you when I designed this slide.
Yeah.
Because I think that most of your criticisms actually falls in the right spot right there. Because that is really the reduction that I'm also disagreeing with. It's basically saying we can explain what it is like in terms of sensory-motor skills. Right, that's what you're objecting to, reducing it to sensory-motor skills.
Yeah,
or brain-body-world systems. Yeah,
not
okay.
Sensory-motor skills.
But what we have outside that inner Regan bubble is this thing on the left, which is saying that actually at the core of what we're doing is living being, and that's the starting point that we always need to start from and come back to. As Michelle always points out, right, experience is where we start from and come back to, is at the core of the inactive approach.
So you are already positing
exactly
subjectivity right there at the start, in which case,
it's
constituting it.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's not something that can be explained through the inactive process. It's already there.
That's exactly my objection to this. You're already imposing it.
But your simulations are entirely within the Regan Noe portion.
That's why I said, is this really embodied, inactive or embodied embedded? And then I said, okay, well, maybe I should just...
Yeah. I know that. I'm just thinking that might help them realize that that's not the full picture. So the simulations were only within the Regan Noe portion of that.
I absolutely see the utility of doing the simulation and, you know, trying to see how far it extends. I'm simply saying, look, when you're moving from a big system back to, you know, a little simulation, then trying to extract back to big questions, you've got to remember the disconnects, you know, that and pitch what you're doing in a way that the kind of obvious things that we're raising just I mean, you can think it for yourself.
What Tom is saying, Max, is that this diagram...
It would make you to answer.
That's right.
It's found in the right way, and it's found in the right way. Actually... provides.
Yeah, but it's not, well, that's the debate, you see.
It's obvious to him that it doesn't.
Being in the world.
No, by no means obvious.
I know that's what he's trying to do, but I don't think it'll work.
But
it's not third person. He's explicitly advocating a non-third personal science. He said that quite explicitly. So he isn't trying to give a reduction of experience to third personal states. He's trying to include first personal states.
Yeah, sure.
I'm only using the third person stuff
to understand better what it means to be a first person subject, and at the same time I'm saying, you know, what it means to be a first person subject maybe helps us understand better also the material organizations of what it means to be a subject. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying there needs to be a mutual relationship between the two, and I would say that actually both of these realms, the matter and the mind, you know, more fundamental to both of them is lived experience in the pre-reflective sense, and it's only when we start theorizing that the body subject split comes, and then we have a problem. Okay, you know, but I'm saying experientially that is not a problem, and what we're only doing is saying, well, if we see that core of where the two domains emerge out of, well, let's take that as the starting point, and then see whether we can beneficially relate the two domains in a way that illuminates both of them.
How does lived experience in a pre-reflective...
Sorry?
Why does lived experience in a pre-reflective sense
already
assume, you know, the consciousness that you're trying to explain?
I would say that is, you know, consciousness.
Exactly. So you've assumed it.
No.
He's assumed its existence without its explanation. He's trying to yes, of course, it's there to be explained. That's everybody's going to assume that from the outset. But now you want an explanation of it.
But what's the form of the explanation then?
Well, can I give a response? This is basically what Tom and I would say. We were having this discussion when you came down to Sussex. This is my response, and Tom, please dissociate yourself from it. lived experience, it comes from the lived body, and the lived body in very simple organisms doesn't have experience, but it has what, as the organism complexifies, becomes experience. Well, that's the answer, anyway.
Yeah,
that's
a reduction.
I suggest, Tom, that you answer that, if you like, and then we have a break.
Different question. Maybe one more. Okay.
Let's try to close it up, and then we can continue over dinner. Yes.
Okay,
I mean, people who are interested, or we could pull one table together, even. Doable.
No, that's what the lived.
We can pull one table together.
We can pull one table together out of two.
I was already saying that, you know, the...
Okay, wait a minute.
Let's
give Tom a chance to be the center of the discussion here.
Hey.
Okay, let me try to relive, so to speak, the moment when I gave the explanation.
Okay.
Right. I'm saying that lived subjectivity must be our starting point, and where we always check back to, because that's the only... at the end of the day, that's you know, what we have to work with. And of course there is the problem of how do we relate matter to mind, but I think that's a problem that only emerges in the theoretical attitude, right? And so I accept that a problem exists, and we can talk about it, but the way I suggest that we talk about it is to say that we can investigate both of these realms and their subjectivity, but the way we do that is in mutual generative constraints, where things that we look at on one side might give us clues, or, you know, form different kind of questions for the other side, and let's see how we can work on both sides of the gap. I know that you don't like to see it that way, because we've already had this conversation in Sussex, but for me that's the only way to go about it. We have to look at, you know, what is the starting point? How does the theoretical attitude develop out of that, and then poses this question of the problem? But when we go about answering, let's not forget where the problem came from in the first place. And hopefully, by looking at biological subjectivity as an individual, we get a better understanding there, and you know, by looking at lived subjectivity, we get a better understanding there, and maybe we can come up with a coherent picture. But that would be my proposal.
Very, very good.